believe there's some board members have some questions. Okay, the honorable Ms. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Dr. Rader. Dr. Gilman, you mentioned when you were talking that Mr. Jensen was successfully treated for PTSD. So when was that?
Well, I think in the years between 1973 and 2005 when I first saw him.
And what would successfully treated mean? What would
it would mean that he no longer was avoided others, that he had ability to have good contact with other people and care about other people, empathize, that he was no longer having a problem with flashbacks or sleep or nightmares, that he didn't jump every time the helicopter went over, hit the deck, and he was able to remember and discuss the episodes of his life that he had been through with appropriate affect, with appropriate emotions.
So what does remission from PTSD mean?
That means
That's what that means?
That's what that means, yes.
Okay. So it's not cure?
No.
So you never cured, or?
Well, I guess that psychiatrists don't
use that term.
Use that word very often, I'm sorry to say.
Okay, thank you, Dr.
Gunn.
Thank you, Dr.
Thank you, so much. Just a very quick, very, very quick question, because we do need to manage time. But in short, are you saying that he can remember without reliving?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so very much, and thank you.
Real quick, because I was a couple of combat-related PTSD. Did you say he didn't have combat-related PTSD?
Yes, he had what's called complex PTSD.
Okay.
He had it because of his childhood experiences of abuse and neglect.
Okay.
And then it, on top of that, was the combat experience.
Okay, so would he be eligible to receive services at the vet center if he doesn't have the combat-related PTSD?
It is combat-related.
Okay, that's what I was trying to.
He will be at. Yes, George Kirby is waiting to see him.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
Okay.
Any further questions, board members? No further questions from board members. Thank you so very much. And based on what you already suggested, sir, may I request the Dr. Stewart, if he would come forward at this time on the phone. Dr. Stewart, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Would you state your name for the record, sir, and tell the board whatever you need to tell the board, sir.
Okay, my name is Dr. Pablo Stewart. And I take your guidance about keeping this short. A lot of the things that I was going to talk about have been said. Dr. Young has talked a lot about it. So I'll try not to go over things. One thing, in all respects, sir, I just wanted to clarify something that you said earlier, that psychiatry is a subjective science, and it may have been at one time that it was subjective, but with the advances of neuroimaging, the advances of neuropsychological testing, and the other diagnostic methods, and the better understanding we have of the science, that psychiatry is a very objective science. It's a very objective sub-branch of medicine, just as cardiology is an objective sub-branch of medicine. So I just wanted to have the board understand that. At least that's my opinion of where psychiatry is. So, briefly, I am a medical doctor, a psychiatrist. I went to college at the United States Naval Academy at Annapolis. So when I graduated, I took a commission in the Marine Corps as a second lieutenant. For the next 4 years, I served as an infantry officer in the Marine Corps. My final assignment being as a rifle company commander in the 3rd Marine Division. And when I got out of the Marine Corps, I went straight to medical school at the University of California, San Francisco, where I also stayed to complete my psychiatric training and had lived there up until July of 2018. So I spent about 40 years at University of California, San Francisco, worked in a variety of settings, including the county hospital. I spent about 7 years of my career really working at the Veterans Hospital, where I ran an inpatient drug and alcohol unit, mainly for Vietnam era veterans who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and also had a substance-related disorder. And last summer, I decided to go to semi-retire, so I moved to Hawaii, where I'm calling from this morning. And I am a clinical professor at the University of Hawaii School of Medicine, where I continue to teach and supervise medical students and psychiatric residents. Now, I say that just as a background, and I think the DSM has been explained what that is. It's the manual from which we, psychiatrists, make our diagnoses. And it has gone through significant evolution over the time. The most current version, as Dr. Gilman said, DSM-5, came out in 2013. At the time of the offense, and I really wish to express my sincere condolences to the families of the victims. At the time of the offenses, as we said, PTSD was not in the vernacular. And so, in getting psychiatric evaluations at that time, it was like the story of the blind man and the elephant, where depending on where you touched the elephant, you had a whole different perspective about what this beast was. And the same thing about PTSD, they have a variety of symptoms that are all related to the exposure to the trauma, where in Mr. Jensen's case is the combat trauma. And since there was no overall understanding, people were saying that, he did this, so then he must be this, and then he has this, so he must be that, which explains why he had all of these different diagnoses. That finally, when he was evaluated by Dr. Yost, who I knew, he's a combat veteran from Vietnam himself and a psychiatrist, and he finally got the correct diagnosis, post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, I just want to kind of put this in context with the board, because I'm almost 70 years old, and I remember serving in the Marine Corps at that time frame. It's difficult to imagine how things were as compared to they are now. Even at the airport, they let the people in military service board the plane first. That's wonderful, and that's how it should be. But that's not how it was in 1973. It was quite the opposite. And the feelings of the American people towards the Vietnam War were very unpopular, got acted out on the veterans. And we were accused of being baby killers and war atrocities and all these drug addicts. And it wasn't true. But that's how we were treated. And so I think we need to put that context into why Mr. Jensen didn't get a fair shake for the psychiatric evaluations back in 1973. Because one, there was no overall diagnosis to capture the symptoms of PTSD. Because that didn't come on until the early 80s, and that really wasn't fully accepted for years after that. And the fact it was really still lingering problems about how veterans were treated and how veterans were perceived. So I really want to emphasize that. And the questions that came up for Dr. Gilman at the end is he cured? Or what does it mean that he's in remission? And I think her answer was very good, that he no longer has active symptoms that affect his behavior. And from a psychiatric standpoint, the best way to determine whether someone is in remission from a condition, be it schizophrenia, depression, bipolar disorder, or PTSD, is to look at their behavior. And I'm very familiar with the Arizona Department of Corrections and the exceedingly challenging nature of being housed in there. the tendency for violence, the really stressful situation, and the fact that Mr. Jensen has done so well that people in the prison have described him as being a model prisoner. If that's the best way to determine that his condition is in remission, because if it weren't, he'd have write-ups for assault, he'd have write-ups for this, he'd have write-ups for any number of things. And he doesn't. He's a model patient. He's been able to take advantage of the resources in the prison to get an education. He's very fortunate that he has a wife that has stuck by him over these entire years. So all of these things speak to his rehabilitation and the safety that he poses when he would leave. I agree with Dr. Gilman. I must qualify that I've never personally evaluated him, but from reviewing the numerous documents and hearing Dr. Gilman's testimony, I absolutely concur with her opinion that he poses no threat to the community if he were released. And the last thing I'm going to say is just to understand his childhood and the onset of PTSD. We understand now that previous exposure to traumatic events and as serious and severe as the combat that Mr. Jensen experienced, those were some of the worst years of the war. And he was in the Marine Infantry Unit, and he also was a recon. I mean, that I can't even begin to express to the board how severe the combat and the trauma that he experienced. But if we have that preceded by abuse and neglect as a child, that made him much more susceptible to developing PTSD. Now, again, I don't think anyone is here saying that, I certainly am not, that PTSD is an excuse for criminal behavior. But it helps us put it in context. It helps us understand it. So with that, I would like to stop and open myself up for questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Stewart. Any questions for Dr. Stewart at this time, board members? Board members don't have any questions for you, but thank you so very much, and feel free to stay on the phone for the rest of the hearing, or unless you have other things to build that in Hawaii. We'll leave it up to you, so I just want to stay on the phone, sir.
Okay. All right, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay, my friends, who should we have come up next?
Next, Mr. Jensen would like to address the board.
Okay, Mr. Jensen, I understand you wish to address the board, sir. Please state your name for the record, sir.
Sean Jensen.
For those in the room, you can see him on this side or that side, but you can't see him behind you unless you turn around. We can see him because we're looking at him from in that direction. So please go ahead, sir.
I would like to make a statement, and at the end of the statement, if you have questions for me, I'd be happy to answer the question. I wrote out some of my thoughts, and I'd like to express them if I may. Over the years, I've never been removed from what I did in 1973, nor should I ever be. There's nothing I can ever say or do to achieve any measure of atonement for the pain that I caused the Burgoyne and Coger families. Rightfully so, I must always live with the seriousness of my actions. Any explanation from 46 years ago was seen by some as not taking responsibility or worse, having no remorse. Needless to say, my sense of judgment, decision-making, behaviors, and actions were clearly flawed at the extreme. To explain what happened in March of 1973 and what I was thinking, I need to provide some background briefly. Just 40 days prior to Kathy and Jim's death, a huge red flag of a flashback circumstance was documented and known to my wife. When she later described to me what had happened and showed me a report with the word flashback, I became much more isolated and alone in my thoughts. I could not see the big picture or the connection of combat in Vietnam. What I saw was much more frightening to me personally. chose not to discuss the prior flashback situation, thinking that whatever was wrong then would somehow, in time, just all go away. Obviously, I was very wrong. And then March 7, 1973 happened. My inability then to explain or find the logic as to why the crime happened actually had nothing to do with connecting the dot as to any possibility of being combat related. I simply never thought of anything in that way, even though I could only describe it, whatever it was, as being like others in Vietnam. I didn't have the slightest clue or know anything about the word flashback in definition, nor the after effects of combat, and certainly never heard of anything called PTSD. I stated what I experienced, but I had no understanding of why I did what I did. Yet the gravity and seriousness of the loss of two young lives was evident and overwhelming for me. I thought, who could possibly believe this? The public hates those of us who served in Vietnam. The VA is removed from hell. This is something the average citizen could never relate to, let alone something I could explain to the authority. I didn't know what to do, so I drew closer to my wife. I just kept thinking Rhonda is my only family, and now everything is ruined. Again, my focus did not center on combat. Instead, it had to do with a family secret. My biological mother's schizophrenia diagnosis, looming in the background, hidden from everyone, especially my wife. This issue was a fear I had all of my life. And did not want to confront. I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Just relax, sir. We're just honorary citizens, sir.
Whether I had control or not, I felt that secrecy was critical. These concerns had become more centered for me, especially given the stark change in my behavior after returning to the U.S. from Vietnam. I was steeped in denial, and continued denial, running from what I then thought was finally the legacy of Josephine, my mother. I questioned how could I possibly know or recognize that her mental illness can actually take hold. The foster family stated it would as a given, so I lived with that fear. The foster mother repeatedly stated that I would someday just be like my mother, Josephine. The language used was hateful and cruel, given the seriousness of Josephine's illness, and often touted in terms of ridicule and humiliate her in order to demean my biological family. Josephine's mental health issues were a constant theme, repeatedly put before me at a very early age and later. Yes, Josephine had a number of hospitalizations, numerous shock treatments, 67 at just one institution alone, and later into prefrontal lobotomy, all revealed to me with ridicule and contempt to explain the reason I was taken from her. My mother, Josephine, and her mental illness were mocked. I was told that they had cut her brain out. They fried her like a chicken. You're going to be crazy like your mother. That's why you're with us, so get used to it. my peer group that I would suffer the same fate. As I got older, I had to look in a dictionary to find the meaning of the word bastard. Then later on, as I got older, schizophrenia. I learned a lot about this mental illness, especially the percentile genetic probability of it being hereditary. I was only 16 and 17 then, living alone in a boarding house and researching my mother's mental illness at the local library, seeking hope that I could escape what my foster family said was inevitable. Fast forward to when I joined the Marines, I was now 17 and a half years old. For me, there was self-worth and meaning. I felt I had value and purpose from ages 17, 18, and 19. I became a seasoned veteran. When I returned to the U.S., I received a security clearance from the academy to become a military policeman. However, it was not long after my return from Vietnam when everything began to unravel. There were absurd, poor decisions, poor behavior and action, completely contrary to my previous years. By the time I left the Marine and met my wife, my goal was to find meaning removed from what I was running from, or so I thought. I felt my relationship with Rhonda would be the best attempt to readjust and find myself once again. Marriage meant a whole new set of priorities, not solely including my concerns. I tried my best, yet even my young new wife could tell that something was out of character. And again, I purposely chose to ignore myself and what I saw as a breakdown or my looming fear. My entire structure of self-discipline was inconsistent, to say the least. I knew it because I needed to be grounded and be connected to my new wife. On the day of this crime, every decision was a recipe of failure. Being alone and having my rifle was completely opposite of what I should have done. However, to my logic at that time, the circumstances was a comfort for me. I certainly didn't intend to be near or around anyone, and had been in the area for a while. I specifically recall a fixed wing that did a low altitude flyover, which was not long before I saw an NVA soldier. I fired immediately, then moved on that position. Again, after realizing the magnitude of what had happened, I was just killed. Two innocent young people. I simply could not grasp or believe it. How can this be explained, let alone be fully understood? It was too much for me then, and I didn't know what to do. The knowing of having killed two persons whom I didn't in any way want to harm was now far more than I could internalize. I could only think, how could this possibly have happened? Now at age 70, and looking back, my failures are evident in what I did then. I, of course, am deeply sorry to the families I've hurt from this crime. I wish that day did not happen, from a series of horrible decisions on my part. At this time, on this day, I want to say what has been in my heart for the past 46 years. I genuinely apologize to the Coder and Burgoyne families who, because of me, carry this deep personal pain for the loss of Kathy and Jim, who they love very much. And for that, I am deeply, deeply sorry. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Sarah. This time, I'm going to see if board members might have any questions. Board members, any questions? No questions at this time. Board members might have some questions a little later, and you will have an opportunity at the end of the hearing, towards the end of the hearing, to make a further statement to the board if you so desire. But thank you for your statement at this time, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, so attorneys, where should I go now?
We have Joe and Donna Giles on the phone.
Okay, Mr. and Mrs. Giles on the phone. Are you still on the phone?
Yes, sir. My name is Joe Giles.
Okay, sir. What do you want to tell the board and the rest of us here today, sir?
Initially, I would like to extend my condolences to the family and the victims. And in no way can I express the pain or loss that they are feeling. I wish the board and they would listen to the following statements from a Vietnam veteran living with post-traumatic stress. I joined the Marine Corps and spent 22 years and retired in 1986. I had a strong desire to help fellow veterans and return to college and obtain a dual master's degree in vocational rehab and addictional therapy. I obtained employment at Bay Pines VA Medical Center in St. Petersburg, Florida. I was now at a position where I could help veterans. I have been married to my wife for over 50 years. During my enlistment in the Marine Corps, I did serve 3 tours in Vietnam. Prior to going to Vietnam, all Marines went through jungle warfare training. This was intense combat training that taught us to react instantly to a combat situation, which would mean the difference between life and death. Sean and I were both assigned to the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, but we served in different companies. Sean was in Labor Company, and I was in Mike Company. We participated in operations such as Union 1, Union 2, Reed River, Mamelon Thrust, and Swift. These operations were search and destroy operations, which means we search for the enemy, and once located, we close within and a firefight or a gun battle would ensue. There were times when the enemy would locate us and ambush us first. Again, this is results in other firefights. We never had any downtime, and once we finished one operation, we would be assigned another one. When we were not on operations, we were assigned to defense perimeters to protect these positions against enemy attack. We would be responsible for bridge security, radio relay outposts, and artillery bases. Even these duties involved patrolling the area, searching out the enemy, and night ambushes. There was no safe place in Vietnam. I had not yet met Sean, but we were both on Operational Swift. This was a devastating operation. Of the 1,100 Marines of the 3rd Battalion, 127 Marines were killed, 196 Marines were wounded. Of those of us who survived, we were numb and felt the loss of our brothers. There was no safe place in Vietnam to return to. We were in constant fear 24/7. There was a need that arose in Vietnam for Marine reconnaissance teams. These teams consisted of 5 to 7 Marines. They would be helicoptered into enemy territory, far from friendly forces. Their job was to locate enemy forces, radio their positions, call in artillery fire, airstrikes to destroy them. These recon teams had to keep moving so as not to be detected. These Marine Corps teams were similar to the Army Rangers, Green Beret, and Navy SEALs. The new battalion, recon battalion that was formed, Marines with recon training were selected, and other Marines were considered that were outstanding in their units. Sean was selected from Lima Company, and I was selected from Mike Company. I met Sean when our company was formed in Vietnam. the battalion was sent to Okinawa for retraining. The training was intense, and those Marines who did not meet the recon standards or the proficiency levels for their job were sent back to their old units. Only the best would stay, and Sean was one of the best. During training, I knew I could depend on Sean as well as the other Marines to cover my back. Sean was able to prioritize and react to any given situation instantly. When we returned to Vietnam in long-range patrols in place, and we were helicoptered and placed in enemy territories, we never knew the enemy forces we would encounter at any given time. We were constantly in fear of being ambushed and losing our lives. But I knew that Sean was with us on these patrols or outposts, and we could count on him. When I returned to stateside, my adjustment was extremely difficult. I sounded a firecracker or a car backfiring triggered flashbacks of Vietnam. Nightmares were frequent. It is sad to say that when the veterans were leaving the military at this time, there was no support system for them or any other veteran. I believe my staying in the Marine Corps and being able to share the horrors of Vietnam with other veterans helped me to deal with my post-traumatic stress. These veterans understood the pain I was in. Yes, the United States government has learned from its mistakes. Sean did not have the support or counseling available for him and for all other veterans at this time. It would be almost a decade before post-traumatic stress was diagnosed as a DSM-3R and years before it was accepted in the medical field. Eventually, I entered counseling with my wife by my side. I learned how to deal with the flashbacks, the nightmares, the guilt, and the loss. I had an excellent counselor because of the intense work that I did with my counselor and with my wife. I was able to process and deal with Vietnam. I still have days that are hard, but I am able to work through them with the tools and the skills that I have obtained. During my tenure at the VA hospital, I was able to help many veterans with post-traumatic stress, drug addiction, and alcohol addiction. I knew post-traumatic stress will always be a part of my life. I also know that I'm a good person and I have the ability to contribute to society, which I have done. From what I have been told, Sean has become a model inmate and has contributed to the enhancement of the lives of the fellow inmates and has demonstrated his ability to become a protective member of society. I thank you for your time, and if there's any other questions, and I'm sorry if I spoke too long.
Thank you so very much. Any questions, board members? Honorable Mr. Johnson.
So first of all, let me thank you for your service. But as we talk about PTSD, have you had any violent encounters with your PTSD, sir?
Have I had violent encounters with PTSD?
Yes, sir.
While I was still in the military, yes, sir.
Okay. Once you got out of the military?
I came close, but because of where I was at with my fellow Marines and with retired Marines, I was able to be guided away until I received my counseling in order to be able to control it and guide it myself.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, any other questions by board members? I don't see any other questions. Sir, did your wife want to make a statement to the board?
I would
I would. It will be very short.
Yes, ma'am. Would you state your name for the record?
My name is Donna Giles. And above all, I too extend my condolences to the families of the victims. In no way can I experience your pain, but I'm asking you to accept the following statement from one living with a veteran with PTSD. I am Joe Giles' wife, and we have been married for 50 years. He served 22 years in the United States Marine Corps, 17 of which I shared with him. He retired in 1986. I truly believe that by Joe staying in the Corps after his return from a third tour in Vietnam was a type of support system and helped him deal with his PTSD. Many of his fellow Marines were Vietnam veterans as well, and they were able to share the horrors of Vietnam with each other that society and even the military could not comprehend, and they wouldn't recognize it for years. For those who returned from Vietnam and were discharged, there was no support, as many people have already said. They were on their own, and many were diagnosed with mental disorders that couldn't have been farther from the truth. PTSD was unheard of, as you're aware now. And if an event triggered a memory of Vietnam, people would judge the vet's reaction as some type of imbalance. I have seen an event or a sound that has triggered a memory for Joe, and his whole demeanor would change. For many years, Joe handled his PTSD by himself. He never shared Vietnam with me. When I would notice a change, he would just say he wasn't feeling well. There was no warm welcome for our returning veterans from Vietnam. They were disrespected, disgraced, and maligned. They were fighting for our American freedom. Some of these veterans gave all, and all gave some, but there were no thanks or outstretched arms to welcome them home, let alone support or help to deal with their experiences. Joe's desire after retirement was to return to college, and he did just that and got a dual master's degree, as he stated earlier. His goal was to help veterans with PTSD. His name became so well known that veterans moving to St. Petersburg would come looking for him because he had a fair and honest reputation. He helped many veterans during his time at Bay Pines. PTSD is not a virus or an infection that can be treated. It becomes a part of your life, and as Joe stated, he did enter counseling, and I was there alongside of him. It took both of us. We were blessed with a wonderful counselor. There were extremely difficult situations, as well as uplifting ones. Joe acquired even more skills and tools to manage his PTSD. I can attest to the fact, through my husband Joe, that those who have PTSD can lead very healthy, protective lives and benefit society if they are given help to do so. We understand that Sean has received counseling for his corrected diagnosis of PTSD and has been very active and instrumental in aiding and helping his fellow inmates. Our brave men and women who keep our freedom free and suffer from PTSD are and can be upstanding citizens, and they're able to contribute to society. PTSD never goes away, but you learn to embrace it and live well with it. There's no doubt that Sean committed that which he has been incarcerated for. I just ask that the board remember that there was no help or support for Sean at that time. From information that we received and from what I have experienced with Joe and I both feel that Sean could truly be an asset to society if he's given the chance. And I thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so very much. Any question, board members? Hearing none from board members, where should we go next?
We'd like to call Jack Lasota.
Okay, thank you. Most Honorable, would you state your name for the record, sir?
I will indeed, Chairman Wright. It's Jack Lasota. And I am appearing here as a volunteer for Sean Jensen. First of all, I remind you that if it appears to the board that there is a reasonable probability that the applicant will live and remain at liberty without violating the law, then the board may, does not have to, but may, release the inmate. I've had the pleasure of meeting Sean Jensen twice at Arizona State Prison in Florida. Florence, and I have personally observed him to be extremely remorseful and penitent, unlike what some of the allegations that have been raised and refuted here this morning. In fact, in 1973 psychiatric evaluations, that was noted even then by folks who then did not pay particular attention to it at the trial. Sean Jensen did not glory in his wartime service. He was heroic. He was given several medals for his service, but he did not glory in his wartime service. In fact, he didn't mention it virtually at all. He expressed no lamentations, no vengeance, no bitterness about the hand he had been dealt. And I think all of you have heard enough to realize that the hand he had been dealt, even before the tragic and senseless murders, was a severely bad hand. But he had no limitation, no questions about anyone. And he carried out a very sound conversation for a couple hours on two occasions. On one occasion, I was accompanied by a friend of mine named Frank Calvary, who's in the audience, who we originally had requested to speak on behalf of Sean Jensen, because it turns out his experiences in Vietnam as a Marine Corps lieutenant, not an enlisted man, but as a lieutenant, were quite similar to Sean Jensen's, except as Frank Elder has acknowledged, Mr. Jensen's were much more severe than his were, much more serious, much more constant. There was never a day that you didn't feel in danger or threatened. Mr. Calvary then asked us not have to get up here and speak, because even after 50 some years, back in society, it's too painful for him to relive the memories of what he went through as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps in Vietnam. And that doesn't mean he committed any atrocities or other tragedies, but he did see plenty of men die, including plenty of men right next to him. So we've given Frank a pass. But I just wanted you to know how seriously, as Joe Giles and his wife have said, the pain affects. And you don't have to have PTSD to suffer from the effects of the Vietnam War. The main thing I'd like to speak further about is the topic of mercy. And that's something that, a word that is not used too often, although Mr. Neal, Commissioner Neal, mentioned it earlier. And I just, there are a bunch of, there's several definitions of mercy that I think ought to be recollected to you. Because it, after all, this is an effort to obtain mercy from you folks. Mercy is the form that love takes when it encounters misery. And here you have a man who has encountered misery for 46 years. He doesn't complain about it. He doesn't bitch about it, but he has been in misery. And that misery has certainly included remorse over the deaths of the Cougar and Burgoyne youngsters. Mercy is a love that responds to human need in an unexpected or unmerited way. And once again, we're seeking that love here to respond to Mr. Jensen's human need and the fact that he might not have many years left, what with his cancer, in an unexpected or unmerited way. Mercy is compassion or forgiveness shown toward someone when it is within one's power to punish. And you are empowered to continue to be part of the punishment of Sean Jensen by denying him his parole. We ask that you forgive him, and even though it is within your power to punish. Mercy is heartfelt sympathy for another's distress. And indeed, Sean was and is living in distress. And then on a more godly level, mercy is love's second name. And finally, it has been said that mercy is the greatest attribute of God. Again, we ask that you extend this man mercy. He merits it. He has been remorseful from day one. He just has not had the means to always express that remorse. But he is a fine man. I'm proud that he's my friend, and I ask that you make a parole recommendation for him. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you so very much, sir. Any questions? I see no questions from board members. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And who's coming next?
Mr. Chairman and members of the board, I believe I am on the agenda next.
That's correct.
Okay, it's been confirmed that you're on the agenda next, so please state your name for the record.
My name is Kirsten Eidenbach.
Yes, ma'am, and what do you want to tell the board and the rest of us today?
Okay, before I begin with my remarks, I do have an extensive history with Mr. Jensen, and while I will be as concise as possible, I do have quite a bit to say that really no one else can speak to, so I don't know if we're planning to break for lunch. I'm happy to stop mid-remark, but I just wanted to give the board a heads up.
Well, I'm going to ask you to be concise, but we're going to continue at this time. But please go ahead, ma'am.
Okay. I first met Sean about 7 years ago through my work on a constitutional class action case called Parsons v. Ryan, that was brought against the Arizona Department of Corrections on behalf of every person currently and who will in the future be incarcerated because the Department of Corrections had failed to provide even the most basic medical, mental health, dental care, and also due to the conditions in solitary confinement. In order to file this case, my legal team and I first had to conduct very in-depth factual discovery. We had to try to get our heads around what was really going on. And early on in that investigation, we met Sean Jensen. And over the course of the case, Mr. Jensen became a named plaintiff. And what that means is that he represented or acted as a representative in the court of law for the entire incarcerated population of Arizona. Mr. Jensen came to our attention because he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And after receiving a radical prostatectomy, he was seen by a certified nursing assistant who acted outside the scope of her practice and inadvertently tore open his surgery site, disconnecting his urethra from his bladder, as Mr. Jensen was left to have urine drained into his abdomen for 3 days before receiving medical treatment. This incident has led to countless surgeries and immense pain for Mr. Jensen, and that is the capacity in which he served as a representative on the Parsons v. Ryan case. His role as a named plaintiff meant that he and I interacted very frequently, and we talked about all kinds of issues ranging from medical to personal. In a case like this, pretty much every part of Mr. Jensen's life in prison was on the table as potential issues for his credibility. The Department of Corrections, we knew, was going to test Mr. Jensen's credibility. And so he and I had very, very in-depth conversations about his philosophy. I have come to know him and his wife, Rhonda, very, very deeply. I'm honored to call them both my friends. But I think I have a unique perspective because Sean and I had to prepare for a trial over the course of several years. I prepared Sean for a lengthy deposition that lasted about 7 hours, and he sat through that, not at that point to further his own medical treatment, but as a representative of the entire population in DOC. At that particular point, Sean had received surgery and was doing better, but he remained committed to the case because he wanted to make sure that the rest of the population, that the guys that he lived with, did not go through what he went through, and that they were not put in the hands of untrained, unlicensed medical professionals, which was a very, very courageous act on his part. Throughout the case, our testifying witnesses have been subjected to intimidation and retaliation, and despite this possibility, Sean has remained committed to the cause throughout. So that was my first exposure to Sean. What I learned about him through this process is that he is resilient. Sean is a cancer survivor who went through an incredibly traumatic physical experience. He has been multiple bouts of cancer recurrence. And in fact, I'm very sorry to inform the board that Sean's cancer is no longer in remission as of today. And that his chemotherapy treatments have not been administered in a timely manner over the past couple of months. So when Mr. Lasota referenced Sean's limited time, unfortunately that has a much graver ring today than it did at his last full hearing. Nevertheless, Sean has always told me, since I'm going to beat this, he's always strong, he's got a good, positive attitude, he doesn't let the cancer get the better of him, and quite frankly, I think that's why he has survived as long and as well as he has, because he has not let himself get mired in bitterness over his situation. He's a very courteous gentleman, and even when he is in a great deal of pain, Sean always gets up and holds my chair for me, despite my protestations. This is the kind of chivalrous behavior that Sean, it comes naturally to him. This is who he is. Also, through my interviews with other prisoners, I have learned and heard about over and over again what an educator, mentor, and student Sean is within the prison system. He is an incredibly intelligent man. He's very well-spoken and eloquent, and he has the capacity to absorb very high-level intellectual information. He, though, does not just keep that information to himself. he has a deep willingness and drive to share this information, to share his love of learning with other prisoners. He collaborates, he develops deep friendships with them, and he mentors them. And I believe you'll hear from some of these gentlemen a little later this afternoon about what a profound impact he's had on their lives. And through all of this, he leads by example. As was referenced in the beginning of the hearing, Sean does not do drugs, he does not drink, he does not have tattoos. He leads by example. He has been a graduate student within the walls of prison, and the other prisoners look up to him as an example of what they can do if they stay on the straight and narrow and put their minds to it. My other hat in all of this is that I run a nonprofit organization called Atlas Justice Center. And the focus of Atlas Justice Center is on helping people who are coming out of prison successfully reintegrate into society. We have been around for a few years, and one of the things that I have learned in working with others who've re-entered is that wanting to do well is not enough. You need to have a clear plan for what you're going to do, how you're going to handle difficult situations, who your support system is. You need to have all that mapped out before you leave. Because the reality is when you get out into society, your criminal record is going to open you up to a lot of obstacles that those of us without criminal records do not ever face. You will be judged, often very harshly. You may have difficulty finding a job. People will shun you. All of that needs to be thought about and planned for before the release occurs in order for it to be successful. And so what Sean and I have been working on over the past several months is a ministry plan where we have very candid discussions about the situations that scare him or make him nervous, what he's going to do in those situations. We have written scripts to help him address those situations so that by the time they actually occur, he's comfortable with what his response is. We have mapped out goals for him. We have also certainly not taken lightly that while he and Rhonda have been married for many, many years, they have not lived together for many, many years. And so we have taken the time to really think through how they're going to come together as a couple and cohabitate, because that doesn't just happen. Marriages take a lot of work. So in your packet, and because I know the board is trying to move things along, I will not walk you through all of Sean's maps, but I hope that you take a very long look at these maps, because they are the culmination of a very thoughtful and mindful approach to Sean's reentry. He is in no way entering the community thinking that he can just walk out of the prison gate and be fine. One of the key components of this reentry plan is on very affirmative and proactive plan to manage his PTSD. He knows that he's currently in remission. He also knows that going into society is going to put before him very challenging obstacles. And so, in addition to the cognitive behavioral therapy that he underwent while he was in prison, which is the therapy that ultimately led to his remission, Sean will be attending therapy sessions at the VA, as Dr. Gilman mentioned earlier. But he also has educated himself on the symptoms that he needs to watch for within himself and come up with action steps, concrete action steps that help him, if I'm having these symptoms, this is what I need to do, so that we never, ever get past the initial symptoms should they arise at any point. Now, just making sure, trying to get through this quickly for you all. It's worth noting that even though Sean is statistically and psychologically no risk if he is released, we've still taken the time to come up with a very comprehensive reentry plan because we want to be mindful and thoughtful about how this process unfolds and also not be naive. The reality is that Sean has lived inside prison, albeit as a model prisoner and staying largely clear of a lot of the politics that dominate most people's lives and interactions in prison. But nevertheless, he's lived in a society that is structured for him. In prison, prisoners make on average 600 decisions a day. Those of us on the outside make on average 6,000. Compound that with the advances in technology that have occurred since 1973 to now, Sean is going to be in sensory overload, and we are very proactively managing that to ensure that his PTSD remains managed and in remission. And that's why, as someone who professionally has worked with Sean over the course of several years, and also knowing him on a very personal level, I can say that I concur with the opinions of both of our psychiatric experts that Sean presents no risk of reoffense should he be released. He has a very strong support system. That support system knows that he will reach out to them. They know who they are. He knows who they are. And we're there to help him through every step of his reentry process. So with that, I understand that the reentry atlas that you all have is the first that you've ever seen because it's the first I've ever created. And the reason that it's structured the way it is as opposed to a narrative is that this is a map. It's an atlas that Sean will actually use during the course of reentry. These maps represent images that have meaning specifically to Sean, so that in addition to the substantive content of the map, the images themselves are meant to elicit certain responses from him. So that when he does encounter difficult situations, or if he knows a situation is coming up like his 6-month mark where we're going to be assessing whether he's progressed towards his 6-month goal, he has a visual representation of that. It's a much more manageable way to present the data where he doesn't have to go back and read a report about what he's supposed to do. This is an atlas. It's his guide to reentry. So I'm happy to answer questions from the board about Sean's participation on the Parsons v. Ryan case, Sean as a person, and also the support role the atlas will take when Sean is released. I should make a note, Parsons is a complex legal case, and I very much heard the board's admonition this morning that you all are not lawyers. But what I do want to tell you about that case is that the case itself is closed. It settled in 2014, and the state and the plaintiff class entered into a settlement agreement whereby the state would improve health care over the course of years. So the case is not actively before the court at this time. What it it's in what's called the enforcement phase, which is where the state is complying with its obligations under the settlement agreement. That being said, in other states that have had health care systems as profoundly broken as Arizona's, it has taken years, if not decades, for that case to resolve. So in terms of Sean's cancer treatment, and particularly in light of the news that Horizon, the private healthcare contractor supervising healthcare for prisoners, was removed by the Department of Corrections a couple of days ago, it certainly cannot be guaranteed that Sean will have access to constitutionally appropriate medical care should he remain incarcerated. So happy to take any questions from the board at this time.
Thank you, ma'am, for your coming for the board members and the questions. I don't see any questions from board members at this time. Now, let me just, as this chair, I'm going to make some decisions at this point. I'm going to suggest, sirs, ma'am, that you work with your rest of your people, give them an hour total, and then after we're going to break for lunch. 30 minutes, then after your 1 hour, then we're going to victims. So, okay, so now I'm going to call it 12 o'clock. Well, it's not 12 o'clock, so we will return at 12:35, and you will have 1 hour from 12:35 until around 1:30. Then at that time, we will go across the aisle, and if any objections coming from the victims at this time, am I using that as our guide for to begin the afternoon?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, well, thank you so much. We're on recess for lunch. And those of you who haven't been here before, lunch can be purchased now in the next building, not in this building. No lunch in this building unless you want to go to a machine and put some money in a machine. Thank you so very much, and we'll see you in about 30 minutes or so.
Thank you.